WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Nick Hornby is great at writing about pop culture obsessives. His novel High Fidelity was about a guy in his 30s who runs a used record store and judges everyone according to their taste in music. His second novel, about a boy, has just been released in paperback. It's about a 36-year-old guy who spends his days and nights immersed in his record collection or watching television. It's hard for him to have relationships with women until he figures out that a lot of men don't like dating single mothers, so he'd have less competition and more appreciation in that field. This seems like such a good strategy. He eventually invents an imaginary child so he can pose as a sympathetic single father, even though he doesn't much like children. Through this little scam, he ends up meeting a 12-year-old boy named Marcus, who becomes quite attached to him. Terry spoke with Nick Hornby last year. They started with a reading. Will, the main character, is involved with a single mother named Angie, who has two kids.
They went to McDonald's. They went to the Science Museum and the Natural History Museum. They went on a boat down the river. On the very few occasions when he had thought about the possibility of children, always when he was drunk, always in the first throes of a new relationship, he had convinced himself that fatherhood would be a sort of sentimental photo opportunity, and fatherhood Angie style was exactly like that. He could walk hand in hand with a beautiful woman, children gambling happily in front of him, and everyone could see him doing it, and when he'd done it for an afternoon, he could go home again if he wanted to. And then there was the sex. Sex with a single mother, Will decided after his first night with Angie, beat the sort of sex he was used to, hands down. If you picked the right woman, someone who'd been messed around and eventually abandoned by the father of her children, and who hadn't met anyone since, because the kids stopped you going out, and anyway, a lot of men didn't like kids that didn't belong to them, and they didn't like the kind of mess that frequently coiled around these kids like a whirlwind. If you picked one of these, then she loved you for it. All of a sudden, you became better looking, a better lover, a better person. As far as he could see, it was an entirely happy arrangement. All those so-so couplings going on out in the world of the childless singles, to whom a night in a foreign bed was just sex. They didn't know what they were missing. Sure, they were right-on people, men and women, who would be repelled and appalled by his logic, but that was fine by him. It reduced the competition.
That's Nick Hornby reading from his new novel, About a Boy. I think a lot of single mothers assume that men find them difficult because of the child. How did you come to see the other side of that?
Well, I know a fair few people who had gone out with almost a string of single mothers, and I think that for some of them it was kind of a rehearsal for what they wanted to do later on, but not something they were ready to do properly yet. And so these people kind of met their needs. I mean, that sounds cynical, but I don't think they were intending it to be cynical at the time. But I think it does have an appeal for men.
Your main character, Will, is actually very afraid of the idea of being a real father. He thinks that children really mess up people's lives and mess up people's marriages, and they're sloppy and messy and time-consuming. Did you go through a period of that yourself, watching your friends who were married and who were having children and who had less time for movies and books and soccer matches, the things that you're really obsessed with?
Well, I think that everyone who knows anyone with a child or has children themselves goes through this.
Did it make you think, well, I'm not going to fall into that trap and have children myself?
No. I mean, I have a child, so and it was a conscious decision to have a child. So clearly, it didn't affect me all the way. But I think if you ask any parent, they have a fantasy that they want time and space, and of course they wouldn't be without their children. But time and space is a really big deal.
The main character in your book is wants to be basically a pop culture mentor to the 12-year-old who enters his life. And I think that that's the fantasy that a lot of adults have, a lot of adults who are really deep into music and movies and television, that, well, maybe it's hard for them to relate to teenagers, but they can relate to teenagers on the basis of, you know, movies and books and television shows and all of that. Was that a fantasy of yours, that, you know, you would have this kind of natural connection to teenagers, no matter how alienated the teenagers were?
I taught for a while, and part of the reason that I wanted to teach was because I thought, you know, I could connect with kids because I knew who the Sex Pistols were and who played for Manchester United. But you kind of get disabused of that very quickly, I think, because any cool kid really doesn't want to know what an old guy, especially an old guy who's a teacher, has to say about anything at all. Marcus, in the book, he knows nothing, and because he knows nothing, he's struggling at school. So Will can fulfill a need in him.
But you found it hard to fulfill that need as a teacher. Well, the kids didn't have that need, I guess. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean,
they already knew stuff.
Yeah, when one has the fantasy that you're talking about, I think it's quite right. Adults do have that fantasy, and you have the fantasy that you're going to be sitting down with the coolest kid in the class and talking about, you know, REM or Nirvana. And they really don't want to hear from you, those kids.
I'll tell you what I think the fantasy really is, too, that a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, and maybe early 50s have. I think it's this, that when they were teenagers, they were much hipper than their parents were. But now that they're adults, they're a lot hipper than their kids are. don't you think?
I think that's absolutely right, yes.
How old were your students when you taught?
I taught 11 to 16-year-olds.
And you were teaching them English?
Yeah.
And what did you feel you could best relate to them about?
Actually, soccer was okay, because there isn't a kind of hip thing or an unhip thing. There's just kind of knowledge, really. And you can just talk to kids about sport as equals, whereas I think with pop music, there's always a lot of jousting going on, and if you're older than, well, obviously a teacher, you're older than your kids, and I think you always want to say to them, yeah, well, they're good, but, you know, have you listened to the Velvet Underground, because that's where they're getting this stuff from, and that's where the kids start to, you know, they start to roll their eyeballs and walk away from you.
Well, how would you feel when that happened?
What, with kids walking away from you?
Yeah, after you suggested a band as worthy as the Velvet Underground, to have a kid like roll his eyes and walk away and see you as the tedious adult.
Well, it's actually what happens with all culture, isn't it, in schools, that you see a kid reading a book that's one-tenth as good as The Catcher in the Rye but tries to aim for the same kind of thing, and you try and suggest The Catcher in the Rye, the kid's going to walk away as well. And it's really a way of turning pop culture into high culture, where some things are better than other things and some things are worthier than other things, and kids really don't want to know about that. They want to know about who's hip and who's not hip and who means something to them now at this moment, and not who's going to last and who's not going to last.
There's a lot of depression in your new book. The mother of the teenage boy is a suicidal depressive. Kurt Cobain kills himself during the course of the book. There's a teenager who's, a depressive. Were you thinking about how frightening it must be for young people when there are people who are chronically depressed in their life, and how difficult it must be to understand and to cope with?
Yeah, and I'd had bouts of depression myself in my late 20s. And I kind of, it is something that interests me, I think, depression. I think probably all three of my books have dealt with depression in some way or another. I think Rob in High Fidelity is kind of gloomy, if not depressed, and I wanted to take that a step further. But one of the things that I do in spare time is I'm a patron of a children's charity called Young Minds, which is actually supposed to deal with kids who have mental health problems. I mean, not handicaps, but mental health problems. There's no other charity like it in the UK, and that is something that I think is incredibly important, that we tend to underestimate kids' depression.
Do you think you had depression as a kid?
Yeah, I think probably I did, actually, for a couple of years in my early teens. I mean, maybe I was just having teenage blues, but I think for all of us it's very hard to separate one from the other.
Do you think that depression kind of helps feed your recorded movie and television and book habits, you know, your obsessions with immersing yourself in that part of life.
I think that's right. I think that, you know, I've always had a theory that obsessives do have some sense of depression, and that obsession is a form of oblivion in a way. That, you know, if you can train yourself to spend 3 or 4 hours in a second-hand record shop flicking through album sleeves, that you don't have to think about anything else. So I think that there's got to be something of that in there. But I think that depression has definitely fueled my writing, and I think that one of the things that strikes a chord with people is that a lot of them are gloomy.
A lot of the characters are gloomy?
No, a lot of the readers are gloomy, and they kind of recognise that. I mean, it's a lot of it is a comedy born of glumness.
Nick Hornby is my guest, and his new novel, which we're talking about, is called About a Boy. I read in a review of one of your books that your son is autistic, and I was thinking, you know, after reading this book about an adult who first relates to a teenager, you know, who first has a teenager come into your life, how totally unprepared you must have been to have a child who is autistic and who is going to be, you know, very different from whatever expectations you had when you decided you were going to become a father.
Yeah, I think, especially if you make your living out of words, the kind of basic expectation you have as a parent is that whatever else you're going to be able to talk to your kid. My kid doesn't talk, so that was a huge readjustment to have to learn about.
You probably also had all these fantasies about being this kind of pop culture mentor to your child, you know, teaching them about your favorite books and records and movies, etc.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of do that. And my son really likes music, and he watches a lot of videos, although he watches the same sort of 4 videos over and over again. But that's not such a big deal, really. I'm sure that he will respond to music in some form or another. I think that you just have to be inventive in the ways that you relate.
I'm wondering how it's hard to answer questions like this without, you know, being false, I think, but how do you think you've been changed by having a son who is autistic and being exposed to a completely different way of relating to the world?
That is a very hard question to answer. I think that it's made me tougher in some ways. That I think when I first started writing and the writing really took off quite quickly in England with my first book, and I think it's quite easy to get overwhelmed in those circumstances, that you end up doing what people want you to do, and it's hard to say no to things. But the moment that Danny was diagnosed, it became much easier in a way to keep time for yourself and to almost hide behind him to a certain extent. You can afford to be much tougher with people as a result of something like that.
What do you mean to be tougher with people?
I don't really. it's very easy for me now to tell people to shove off if they're kind of getting in my face or wanting to take up time. Because the time is for Danny. Also, money is for Danny as well. So it kind of makes you feel better about earning. And, you know, I've earned quite well over the last few years. And that makes you feel kind of weird, I think, at first, because you think, what's all this for? But now I know what it's all for.
Right. The title of your new book, About a Boy, is named after a record. Do you want to talk a little bit about the record you named it after and why?
Yeah, it's quite complicated, and it turns out it's named after several records. I thought of the title after the Nirvana song About a Girl, and the book is set in at the end of 93, beginning of 94, and Kurt Cobain's death does feature in it, so it seemed entirely appropriate. And the boy, as in About a Boy, I think it could refer to either Marcus or Will. But then I remembered, actually, I had completely forgotten that Patti Smith wrote a song called About a Boy, about Kurt Cobain, so I guess I must have pinched her title rather than the Nirvana title.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Terry spoke with Nick Hornby last spring about a boy is just out in paperback. His first novel, High Fidelity, is currently being made into a movie starring John Cusack. This is Fresh Air.